Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
What I'm trying to do is to normalize being a hot mess. Even if you're successful and doing all these things, and you know, that's my life. But I still cry in the shower, you know, sometimes. So I think realizing that you can still have a happy life even though you've got some darkness in you, I think that's the way to go.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. You know Alan Cumming. Depending on how old you are, you might remember the Scottish actor as Eli Gold on The Good Wife, or the Pee Wee Herman-esque TV host in the Spy Kids movies, or the MC in Cabaret.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome, fremda. Étranger, stranger.
Alan is 56 now, and he's just written a memoir called Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life. It begins around the time that he first performed that role in Cabaret in the mid-1990s, as his career was taking off and he was figuring out his public identity.
I was in Hollywood. I was making a couple of big films there, and I found these pair of glasses sunglasses stall at Venice Beach, and they were just round black glasses, and they didn't have any, you know, they didn't have black sunglass stuff in them. It was just clear, and I just thought these were the greatest frames for me. And I write about in the book about how there's a play by Terence McNally about Maria Callas, and she says everyone must have a look, and she's doing this lecture, and she looks at this person, and the audience goes, "You do not have a look." And I think that became my look, because it's a look that really suits me, and I bought them, and I thought, I'm going to make these my prescription glasses. And I went to Australia, and I got the lenses put into the frames in a little optometrist in Melbourne. And the lady was, that's where my favourite Australian saying came about. I said, "Are you able to do this? You know, I've got these sunglasses, and can you put my prescriptions in? And I'm only here till Friday. Can you do that?" And she went, "Shouldn't be a drama." And I just love it because... it shouldn't be a drama. You know what I mean? It was just that great, absolutely sort of, you know, jaded and dour kind of delivery of this lady saying something was absolutely true. It shouldn't be a drama. And I just love that.
Alan was attracted to this no drama mantra after a period of a lot of drama in his own life. His first marriage had fallen apart. He was struggling with an eating disorder, and he was coming to terms with the physical and emotional abuse he'd endured from his father when he was a child. When his marriage ended, Alan moved into his own place for the first time, which suddenly forced him to make choices about what he wanted his life and his surroundings to look like.
I discovered that I really like colorful things, bright things. You know, in my first marriage, I very much gave all that sort of responsibility to my wife, and I'd never had to sort of understand what I liked in that way. I was very passive, and then all of a sudden I was 30 and I had this apartment and it was mine. I could do whatever I liked with it, and I thought, what would I do? I just painted the entire thing bright yellow.
And I want to ask you about your eating at the time. You describe struggling with an eating disorder, but what were the, how did you understand it at the time? What was happening with how you were eating?
I was aware when people started to get worried about me and sort of say, you're too skinny, you're not eating enough, you know, and I, you know, you sort of, you know, maybe skip a few meals, you sort of think, oh, well, whatever. And then it becomes a habit, becomes a pattern. I mean, I realized it was the only way I could control. It was the only thing I could control in my life. I mean, I think that's what all eating disorders are about. People feel out of control, and the only thing they can control is their body. And then that becomes an addiction about eating less and less to sort of, you know, that's some only thing you can control. And, you know, you don't quite realize that at the time, but then I got really annoyed with everybody for being so concerned. I thought, you know, don't be concerned about my weight, be concerned about me. And it made me want to do it more. I remember having a dinner with friends when they came to see me in a show in Cabaret, actually, when I did it first in London. And, you know, I was sort of sitting at the end of the table, just sort of picking at a salad, being very antisocial. And I remember they're all really concerned. So it's just all, and it's sort of funny, you feel very objectified and that people are only talking about your body, not about you. And also I felt I was very much sort of being lauded for being skinny. You know, that was something that was happening as my skinniness was sort of a prefix to everything I did.
When was the first time you talked to another man about having disordered eating?
I had a therapist around about that time called Chris in London. So I think it would be him. Yeah. I mean, I didn't really speak to anyone about what was going on with me. I kind of hid it all. So it was a really, really, really difficult time. And, you know, now I understand all these things. I understand these things about eating and the power thing. And about, you know, I understand that I was depressed because I was having flashbacks, repressed memories coming, a very violent, horrible thing. So then I talked to, I think it was talking to his therapist about it. He was great, actually. It's like, you know, sometimes you just, all the stars align and you meet someone who just, you are able to connect with, a therapist. I mean, I think it's a very intimate and sort of chance-like, you know, interactions. And with him, I think it was a lot going on and he was really, really helpful. You know, he was my sort of savior in a way. He really gave me back my confidence.
Do you find when you're stressed now in your life or years after you were 30, do you find that sometimes it shows up with the way that you eat?
It has a few times. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's spaces where I sort of, you know, been so busy, you forget to eat and you kind of slightly get off on the fact that you haven't eaten and stuff like that. And then you can sort of see changes in your body. And also, you know, as you get older, things, your body changes, your metabolism changes. Like right now, I feel like I have put on a little bit of weight. I've noticed. I did this show in August going around Scotland in a van with Miriam Margolyes, the English actress, sort of a travel series for Channel 4. You know, we had chips, French fries, with every meal for like a month. And I was like, including breakfast. And, you know, then I came back to New York and suddenly it was Fashion Week and I was doing all these events and I was, you know, and I'm going for fittings. And I used to, I'm sort of sample size. And so you know, I don't have to go for fittings. People just send clothes over and they fit. And also I've been doing quite a lot of, you know, exit weights and things in the pandemic. So my chest has got a little bigger. I've gone to a 40 chest. Can you believe
it? Wow.
And then I sort of thought after all the chips in Scotland, I put on a little bit of weight on my tummy and I was like, ooh, this 32 waist, a little tight. So, you know, I notice things like that. I kind of like being sample size. and, you know, I kind of keep fit and all that sort of stuff. But it's not sort of, I don't see it in quite the sort of negative, damaging way. I don't sort of think I need to do this because that's the only control I have over my situation in my life. Not at all. But I'm always very vigilant about it tipping into danger areas.
When you think about like that first period of your life when you really felt like you got to feel carefree and have fun, how much was sex and drugs part of that?
Not like a massive part though, but I sort of, you know, sex was, I definitely went into a phase where I was having a lot more sex and yeah, I kind of, you know, that was sort of, that was fun. And I that relationship as in was very sort of very sexual one. And in a really healthy way, I think. And then when that ended, I kind of, you know, sort of expanded a little more my sexual partners and stuff like that, and had a few years of being very, I guess that was my more debauched phase. And that's where I kind of, you know, I would go out dancing, you know, and ecstasy was the sort of party drug of the time, and I used that. I've never kind of done. I'm not sort of a. I like getting stoned. I'm a bit of a stoner, and I like drugs that make you feel happy. You know, I don't like drugs that make you speedy and wired and kind of mean and paranoid. I like to relax and have fun and feel positive and loved up.
When you think about. You said your debauched years, your more debauched years. Was that like the late 90s? When was that period of your life?
Yeah, so yeah, the late 90s, including and into the 2000s, actually. Yeah.
And can you put to words, like, for you doing ecstasy and feeling loved up, like, what did you like about the feeling? What did it open up for you?
What I like about it is this sort of this tingly feeling. Your body is kind of, you have these rushes and it's all sort of tingly and you're sort of breathless almost. And it's a bit like having a panic attack. It's kind of like what happens when you have an actual panic attack. And then it kind of changes into this really euphoric sensual glow. So what I really liked about it was that it mirrored the beginning part, mirrored what I was experiencing quite a lot in my life at that time, which was being sort of a bit short of breath and panicky and, you know, anxious. And then it mirrored that, but then it forced me to sort of go over the edge into total relaxation and joy and release. And that I couldn't do in real life. I kind of self-medicated with ecstasy. And I think it actually worked. It really did the trick.
Coming up, Alan tells me about meeting his now husband and deciding to settle down.
If you're going to start a new relationship when you're 40, you should think that this is it. And so if it's going to be it, you want to just look back at all your other relationships, say, okay, what went wrong? What was I bad at? What was I good at? What do I need? Let's just get it on the table.
We've been hearing from quite a few of you about housing since we asked to hear from those of you who consider your current situation temporary. You've sent in stories about the quest to find something more affordable, about moving back home, and about other short-term choices you've had to make. We're compiling these for an upcoming series we're working on with BuzzFeed News all about housing. And we recently heard from a listener named Tavi, who has been living in the Bay Area since 2007.
If you were queer or an artist, trans, if you were a sex worker or a performance artist, like, this was the place. And it was kind of bohemian paradise, if you will.
Tavi bounced around a variety of living spaces until January, when they said they were illegally evicted from their last place. They found temporary housing through a friend, but it only lasts until June of next year. And Tavi said it no longer feels sustainable to stay in the Bay Area. So they're hitting the road this summer to figure out where to live next.
I am converting my Prius to a live-in tiny home on wheels, and my plan is to go state by state and both see places that I, as a queer and trans person, might feel safe living, and also while I'm at it, I'll see some national parks and beautiful places, have some adventures, and that's my plan. Wish me luck.
If you're also in a temporary housing situation, tell us about it. Record a voice memo and describe your current living situation to us. Then email it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen. And her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Dakota Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. After his first marriage ended, Alan Cumming had a series of relationships with women and men throughout his 30s, including one that he now describes as abusive and sometimes even violent.
Not like violent in the scale that my father was, but when that came into it, I was like, oh, this is really, we've got to get out of here right now. They were angry and I thought I could fix them. I thought it was my fault and that neither of those things were true.
So then when Alan was first getting together with his husband, artist Grant Staffer, he knew he wanted to do things differently.
I'd, you know, definitely been around the block a few times. So I was very in a phase of now being very sanguine and sort of honest and not trying to sort of sweeten myself, and because I knew what I was capable of and I knew what I needed, and I just thought I don't want to go through some other mess, you know, I don't want to do that again. Obviously I just was falling in love with them, but I also just didn't want it to, I didn't want to blow it, and I didn't want to sort of present a false picture of myself. And he did that too. You know, he came back to me with his honesty. And so it was a really great way to start a relationship.
Hmm. When you think about the beginning of that relationship and that honesty, were there ways that you sort of structured what you wanted to expect from one another in a relationship that you verbalized that you hadn't in previous relationships about how it could work?
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't really ever done that before. You know, I just thought you just sort of meet someone, you fall in love with them, you just kind of think, oh, here we go. Whereas I think that, you know, I mean, he said to me that, you know, it's he knew me quite well by this point. And he said, you know, it seems you like drama and I don't want to do drama. And he was right. It did seem like that. I had a lot of drama going on in my life, in my personal, you know, love life, if you will. And I said to him, I know it looks like that, but seriously, I do not want drama. I am to blame for that. I let it happen. I stayed and, you know, I was in a cycle that I wasn't very proud of and I couldn't get out of, and I felt I could fix it. And that's the thing, when you're in an abusive relationship, the first time something crazy happens, you sort of think, oh gosh, that was terrible. I wonder why that happened. And then once it's happened two times, then it becomes the norm, and it's, you know, and then there you are, you're in this really mental's not quite the best, but sort of, you know, screwed up and unhealthy thing, and it becomes your norm so quickly. And so I was realizing all those things about myself. I was realizing that I needed to break the cycle of those trying to fix people and allowing myself to fall into those situations because it was familiar to me, you know. That's what I was realizing. It was where I was comfortable, even though it was awful. So that was a situation where I was like, no, I don't want, I really don't want that. It's not my sweet spot.
2 years later, Alan and Grant got married in London in a civil ceremony and were married again in New York in 2012.
In your relationship now, is monogamy important to you?
No. I mean, it's not something that I think is essential to my well-being. I wasn't successful at being monogamous when I thought that it was the best thing to do. I think by my very dint of my gender, that's a more difficult thing for me to achieve or to maintain. And then I just sort of over the years sort of realized that it wasn't, why was I, if something happened, why would that be the worst thing in the world? I've seen so many relationships just end overnight because of one stupid sort of, you know, blowjob or something. I just think it's so ridiculous that, and I think there's many, many ways that you can betray someone much more deeply than that. And if you have a situation where you have talked about the fact that might happen in your life and that you will handle it with kindness and respect and care, then it becomes less scary a thing. I think, you know, more so in same-sex relationships, it's something that people have an understanding of, and that if it happens, it's either understood or it's agreed upon, or it's just a sort of thing that, you know, you've talked about it and you've come to some agreement about it that suits you, that suits your relationship. But for me, I feel like I'm not going to pretend I'm going to be able to do something that I just know I can't do, and also that I don't want to do. It's not that I go around having sex with people all over the place. But if that were to happen, I feel that that's, you know, something that we've sorted out between us.
You write in the acknowledgments of your book about your husband. He was responding to seeing you on social media intoxicatedly crowd surfing wearing a monkey suit on another continent. And you quote your husband saying, "Alan is a butterfly and we have to let him fly." And what a loving, loving thing for a partner to say that is both seeing you and fully, like, loving you and how you are in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. And, like, sometimes, like, you know, over the last year, like, with the pandemic and, you know, there's times when he was very worried. I was starting to travel again, and you know, just he was very worried about because I'm asthmatic, and you know, before we were vaccinated, it was quite scary. You know, I was worried about if I caught it, how my asthma might, it could be really difficult for me. And I remember there was one time where he didn't want me to go to the supermarket, and he goes, "Well, let me do it. I'll go, and you stay here." And I said, "You are trying to keep me in a room. You're trying to. It's like that film." With the, you know, you can't keep me in the house. You're asking to sort of imprison me in the house.
Wait, are you talking about the Brie Larson movie where she's stuck in the house?
Yes, yes. It was a little more swanky than that, the room I was in. But nonetheless, you know, I was saying to him, you can't do that. You've crossed a line that, you know, I'm a grown up. He was just anxious and being kind, you know, being caring. But sometimes people's caring and anxiety can kind of go too far and sort of impede your life. So anyway, when that was all happening, I said, "I'm a butterfly, remember?" And he was like, "Yes, oh yes, you're right. I've got to let you fly.
You have to go to the store. You can go to the store."
I have to go to the supermarket, yes. Even butterflies have to go to the supermarket.
Is there anything about being 56 that surprises you? Like being this age?
I mean, lots actually, because, you know, I sort of, you know, if I was 20 years ago, I'd think 56, oh my God, I'll be, you know, podgy and in my pajamas all day or, you know, I don't know what I think, but I had this vision of, I mean, I remember when I was at drama school thinking, oh God, 21, my life will be over. 30, ancient. You know, all that stuff that we go, the goalposts change as you get older in terms of what you think of age, what you do at certain ages.
Yeah, you have a line where you write something like, "Life is a slow march to death. We might as well have fun."
Yes, it is though. You know, I'm decaying in front of you right now as we have this conversation. We're both decaying. And I just think, let's just enjoy it, you know, and the whole trajectory of my life is so alien to what I thought it was going to be. It's completely not what I thought was transcribed for me or what I expected or what I hoped even. And so I find it amazing that I'm able to do all the things that I still do and want to do. And I feel like I'm still in touch with, still able to be in touch with, you know, younger people who are young enough to be my children. I have that sort of connection. But at the same time, I've got wisdom from having been through the life I've been through. And so it's a nice combo.
Do you have any fears about aging?
I mean, not about aging as in getting older. And I mean, there's obviously things, you know, you think, oh, is that my shape of my face is a little, I've got little jowls now, or you notice it's harder to lose weight than it used to be. I still feel, you know, fit and kind of healthy, and I like the way my body's going. I like the way I'm looking. I like having grey hair. I, you know, it's funny, the other day I'm doing this film with Katie Holmes and I went for my costume fitting, and in the description of the character, it said he was kind, early 60s, thinning hair. And I was like, well, I can do the kind. And, but you know, I'm sort of into that thing now. I'm playing like people in their 60s. So I got my costume fitting, and I heard myself say, no, this is not good. My ass looks too good in this. And I thought, I'm actually at the stage where I'm trying to disguise I'm trying to make myself look older.
Look a little more frumpy.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of, you know, less high and tight. So we'll see how long that lasts.
That's Alan Cumming. His new memoir is called Baggage: Tales from a Fully Packed Life. And if you or a loved one needs support around an eating disorder, you can call or text the helpline of the National Eating Disorders Association at 800-931-2237. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Afi Yellow-Duke. The rest of our team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, Caitlin Pierce, and Andrew Dunn. Annabelle Bacon also worked on this episode. Our intern is Sarah Dealey. The Reverend John Delure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSalePix, that's P-I-C-S. And the show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to Jill Riley in South Boston, Massachusetts, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Jill and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. Alan has been keeping up with his at-home workouts, and he told me about how he stays motivated while he does them.
In my gym, I have a little shed as a gym where I've been lifting weights and
where
expanding.
Where your chest has gotten chest, large,
my,
yes.
My 2-inch expansion from 38 to 40. I've done this thing where this shed is entirely covered with photographs of me from throughout the years, from magazine covers and film posters.
That's
and
amazing.
Blah, blah, blah. And so I exercise to thousands of images of my younger, hotter self. And it's a very sort of good inspiration to, you know, do another 1,000 meters on the rowing machine or something.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.